Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. By now, it became clear that the suspected New York City attacker on October 31st that left at least 8 people dead was a 29-year-old Saifullah Saipov, an ethnic Uzbek who emigrated to the United States from Uzbekistan in 2010. This is the latest act of terrorism involving Uzbek nationals. Earlier, similar attack took place in Stockholm, also in St. Petersburg and in Istanbul, which raises another critical question. Why are Uzbek nationals often linked to act of terrorism among the population in Central Asia? This is what we plan to debate in upcoming 30 to 40 minutes. To discuss this, I'm joined by Dr. David Lewis, senior lecturer at the University of Exeter and former Central Asia director at the International Crisis Group. Dr. Edward Lemon is joining us, who's the postdoctoral fellow at the Harriman Institute of University of Columbia. He's researching extremism in critical security studies, mainly in Tajikistan, also in broader Central Asia. Surajuddin Tolibov is joining us, who's broadcaster at the Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Uzbek service, and Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlok Owozi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog. Welcome on board, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. So where to start? Maybe, Surajuddin, you could kick off the discussion by explaining what you have been able to learn about the suspect, Saipov, today.
While all journalists in America have been trying to get more information about him, we tried to get hold of his family, to learn more about his family, his environment in Tashkent, where he grown up.
Right.
So he is 29, and until he was 22, he lived in Tashkent in a relatively wealthy family. His parents are traders in a local market. They have several houses in Tashkent. And neighbors told us that they are very secular. They don't practice Islamic rituals at all. And also, until 22, before he got a green card, he graduated from the financial university in Tashkent and worked as an account in one of the central hotels in Tashkent. And he was quite a normal guy. And everybody is shocked in Tashkent, especially in his neighborhood. So they say that they can't believe that such a nice guy, very polite, turned into terrorist.
How authorities in Uzbekistan are reacting to this?
Authorities are very, it seems that are very concerned. There was a statement first by the president of Uzbekistan, who sent his condolences to his American colleague. And he expressed his readiness to cooperate with the USA in fighting against extremism, all sorts of terrorism. And the same day, Jahan News Agency, which belongs to Foreign Minister of Uzbekistan, issued a statement where they said that Saifullah Saipov was radicalized in USA, stressing that not in Uzbekistan.
Anything came out of interrogation involving his family members? I heard that they were questioned on November 1st, the day after the attack.
Yes, we managed to get through the local authorities who has been carrying out investigations since attack happened. And they questioned his family members, his father and mother, and his eldest sister. He has altogether 3 sisters younger than him. And we don't know the details, but as far as I know, they're trying to get as many information, as much information as possible.
Okay. Obviously, it's not the first such attack involving Uzbek nationals. Bruce, earlier you had a very timely analysis on this. Tell us, please, about some of the other recent cases of terrorism involving Uzbek nationals.
Well, I mean, just this year, of course, you had the nightclub attack in Istanbul shortly after midnight, and you know, and there was the St. Petersburg metro bombing. Although that was an ethnic Uzbek that came from Kyrgyzstan that was involved in that, and then, you know, we had the unfortunate incident in Stockholm. And of course, before that, there have been attacks that Uzbeks have been linked to that were well outside the usual places that you would expect to find someone that would be you could label as an Uzbek militant or extremist. You know, I mean, the Istanbul airport, they believe that there was at least one of those people was an Uzbek. But, you know, I mean, I have to say that, I'm real uncomfortable. The fact is that, yes, they were committed by Uzbeks. I'm real uncomfortable with branding the one people or referring specifically to the one group as being involved in this, because they're really distinct from the traditional Uzbek militants that we're used to. I mean, certainly they've been active in Afghanistan and in the Pakistani tribal area, and certainly there have been groups that have gone off to Syria and Iraq. But these are very different, committed cadres in these extremist groups where these... As these other attacks that I talked about that happened this year, you know, it's much harder to figure out what the motivation is for this. They're individuals who, for some reason or another, seem to have had some kind of crisis, personal crisis, and it led them to believe that maybe this was the way to get something done that they wanted. What they wanted to accomplish is not very clear. I mean, you know, there's references. Maybe they had a note saying they pledged allegiance to the Islamic State, so-called Islamic State group or something. But the motivations for this are really hard to figure out. And I know that Edward and David know a lot about this stuff. You know, again, I hesitate to specifically brand Uzbeks for this, although the facts would indicate that you have to accept, you know, that these were ethnic Uzbeks that were responsible for these attacks. Although there's, like I said, it certainly is no reflection on the people, and it seems to just be bad choices by individuals, and only a few of them.
Now, looking into these individuals, as you referred, Bruce, maybe we should bring Edward on here. So what strikes out in terms of their profile, act and actions compared to this and the ones who took place in the past in Stockholm and Istanbul and St. Petersburg?
Yeah, I think there are particular similarities between the attack 2 days ago in New York and the attack in Stockholm back in April. I think in both cases you had someone who seemingly when they left Uzbekistan, as we've already discussed, didn't display any radical views, and then something's happened to them after leaving. Both of them seemingly left for positive reasons. I think we can, from the profile we're building up of Saipov, the attacker in New York earlier this week, you know, he did win the green card lottery, as we've already discussed. He was working in a hotel. And when he arrived in the United States, I mean, I think, you know, he struggled to integrate. He didn't speak English very well, from what we can tell. He initially wanted to get a job in a hotel, a more skilled job, but ended up being a truck driver driving all around the United States and never really finding a foothold even in the Uzbek community. And so I think, you know, you do have these similar dynamics of people being far away from home, people having lost any sort of touch with their community, people having specific issues and sort of, as Bruce mentioned, sort of maybe personal crises or, you know, struggling to find work, struggling to fit in the new society. And I think these sort of factors seemingly have led to these sort of attacks.
Now, obviously, we will get to that topic, Edward. It is also interesting why Uzbek nationals are having this sort of problem. Why not the other migrant workers from Tajikistan, let's say from Kyrgyzstan or Kazakhstan, are not as on the spotlights as the Uzbeks are? Obviously, they should have their own sort of problems like the Uzbeks does. Before get into that, maybe there is an element to compare that. David, if you would like to jump in here. So Tajikistan is a country, and it's gone through lots of problems involving fighting, civil wars, and the authorities would like to call the other side of this battlefield radical or extremists. So when you compare Tajikistan with the ones in Uzbekistan, what strikes out?
Well, I think the sort of big question around this, I suppose, is whether where people come from is any part of this sort of causal process, right? Is it relevant that these individuals are from Uzbekistan or Tajikistan? Does that whole history and that society have any kind of impact? And I think we can, as Bruce is suggesting, we can overemphasize that. But I think there are some differences between Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, not least, of course, that Tajikistan went through a civil war and has had a much more complex experience in some ways of political Islam inside the state. But Uzbekistan, of course, has been this very closed, very authoritarian society with a very limited public space for religious expression outside the official mainstream Islam. And at the same time, and I think this is important, has also been, in many ways, an economic failure. And the result of that has been this huge outflow of labor migrants, not just to Russia, but of course, now we see, of course, the United States to Europe as well. And at the same time, you've got this very strong tradition of Uzbek militancy, firstly in Afghanistan and later on in Syria. So I think this dual diasporas are important when we try to understand what's happening.
But David, all these signs also exist in Tajikistan.
Yes, but just let me finish, because you have a large number of labor migrants that are often dislocated, are often socially isolated, and at the same time, a very extensive network of online, social media that reach out to Uzbeks and are fired by this long tradition of Uzbek militants. And I think that obviously has some kind of impact. The difference from Tajikistan, I think we can overemphasize it. Ed might have some thoughts here as well on the different nature of the communities in the diaspora. There might be some social aspect to that. It seems to me that once you get to the United States, a lot of the traditional social bonds break down, and many of these individuals are very isolated. They don't have traditional communities in those countries that they can align with, not like, for example, South Asian communities who already have a large number of migrants. So they often do become very isolated, it seems to me.
Edward, you like to jump in here? Like, what David is saying, obviously understandable. But my argument is that the same challenges are in Tajikistan, and the same challenges the Tajikistani migrants face when they are outside of the country, in Europe, in the United States. But the act of terrorism, at least talking about the four last actions, they are not Tajiks, but they are Uzbek nationals. Why is that?
I think partly it is a sort of numbers game. There are 30 million Uzbeks as opposed to around 8 million Tajiks. I think, as David has mentioned, there's a much larger Uzbek diaspora community in the United States, in parts of Europe, including Sweden and Germany, as well as in Moscow. And I think, as David and Bruce have mentioned, there are more sophisticated, perhaps, networks of propaganda coming from not only Islamic State, but other militant groups in Syria and Iraq that have recruited Uzbeks. And I think also the level of education of many of the Uzbek migrants is better than many of the Tajik migrants, making them more likely to be bilingual in Russian, for example, which isn't always the case, especially nowadays in Tajikistan. And so they've got a sort of wider array of sources that they can access that potentially can persuade them, as seemingly we saw with the New York attack, to commit these acts.
Is there anything, Sirajuddin, you would like to end this? Obviously, we will have more deeper discussion in the second.
Let me allow not to agree with you, Mohammed, because one should not be misled concluding that Uzbeks are becoming a major source of radicalism.
No, nobody is saying that.
Islamic extremists. Let me explain you. The attack which occurred in Istanbul to the nightclub was committed by ethnic Tajik who grown up in Uzbekistan. Or the attack which occurred in Sweden was committed by ethnic Tajik from Samarkand. It has nothing to do with the ethnicity of these groups. But the level of, and look at the figures as well, the level of terrorism in Uzbekistan, almost non-existent. Over the last 10 years, there were more than 85,000 incidents of terrorism registered all over the world. But in Uzbekistan, only 10. The problem in Uzbekistan with the Uzbeks is to do with the self-identification, I think. In the Soviet time, Uzbeks have been under the secular communist ideology. Almost all mosques had been closed, and most of the religious clerics ended their lives in gulags. But today, we have a mixture of secular ideology covered with traditional Islamic traditions. Those including Saipov, who grown up under the secular mixture of secular and Islamic traditions, I think usually have identity crisis while go abroad. Free internet access in all Western societies allow radical groups easily indoctrinate, radicalize those who have no enough knowledge of religion and socio-political situation overall. The closeness of Uzbek society is, I think, one of the main reasons why Uzbekistanis are becoming as a hotspot of radicalism.
Yeah, that's what we are talking, Sirajuddin. I don't like anyone to get this impression that we are kind of categorically pinning the Uzbeks. What we are saying is among the Central Asian countries, the Uzbek nationals are found behind at least four latest attacks, and we are trying to understand why is that. Now, The most striking question probably is that, Bruce, you mentioned this in your article, why are Uzbekistanis linked more to such actions than nationals of any other Central Asian country? So we will continue the Majlis discussing this and many other questions shortly. Hey, everyone. Before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Majlis podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Gandhara Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Pakistan and Afghanistan from local perspective. And the podcast is published in every second week on Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty Central Asia podcast. In the light of recent attack involving an Uzbek national in New York City, we are discussing possible reasons behind this. Joining me in the discussion are David Lewis, senior lecturer at the University of Exeter and former Central Asia director at the International Crisis Group. Dr. Edward Lemon is joining us from New York today, who is postdoctoral fellow at the Harriman Institute of Columbia University. Sirajuddin Tolibov is with us from Prague, who is the broadcaster of the Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Uzbek service. Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlok Awazi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia blog, also joining us from Prague today. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, gentlemen. So, Bruce, this was the question we wanted to explore today and on the Majlis, and this is coming from your own article from yesterday. So you say, why are Uzbeks so often linked to terrorist attacks when it comes to Central Asia? So, yeah, what you mean? Explain, please.
Okay, well, obviously, there's not going to be any argument I can make here that's going to satisfy everyone or possibly obviously anyone.
Which shouldn't be, but, because this is the beauty of the discussion here.
Yeah, well, we'll see how beautiful this sounds when I start talking, I guess. But certainly all the Central Asian countries have a different experience with Islam and with the way that their own societies have been evolving over this. Now, we know that Uzbekistan is a very repressive country, and the government has been, obsessed with internal security since day one, practically. So they monitor practically every facet of life that they can possibly do on this. We know that they have taken over religion and made it serve the state, which is nothing new for the region actually at all, but certainly they want, it's understood by the people in this country that the Islam that they're hearing about is not probably all of what there is to know about Islam. Now, we know a lot of people in the country are not very religious, and we also know that a lot of people have to go out of the country because there's not enough employment in Uzbekistan to do that. So now you had this person with this experience that maybe they were exposed to a little bit of, they would have heard something about Islam, whether they're, if they're practicing, they would know more, obviously. But even if they weren't a practicing Muslim in Uzbekistan, but they were an Uzbek, they would certainly have some idea about that. And so now they're outside the country. There's much more freedom, access to information. So, and Edward and David both, but certainly Edward has done studies on this. Now you have someone who's outside the country. Maybe they're not making a success out of their life outside the country. They might be lonely. It's hard to find friends. Job opportunities aren't what they expected them to be. You have extra time. You go on the internet, and there's a variety of places you can go and find out more about Islam. We know that these extremist groups are looking specifically on Facebook and other places for these kind of people who have been separated from their communities, down and out, so to speak, looking for some purpose for their life. And these guys know, these extremist groups know how to pick, not only find these people, but then play upon their anxieties, and their hopes, and try to get them out. Going back to Uzbekistan for one more second, because the government has been so hard on Islam there and made it serve government purposes, the only opposition that we've seen in Uzbekistan that was even remotely not successful, but actually got some reaction from the government was the Islamic opposition groups, the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, for instance, but also Hizb ut-Tahrir, other groups like that. So there's at least a kernel planted in the mind of many people in Uzbekistan, probably, that Islam is a possible counterweight to bad governance in the country. So now you're outside the country. maybe you weren't religious at all and maybe not know very much about it. You've come on the internet, you hit on one of these groups, they know who you are, that you're exactly the person that they're looking for. And they start saying things that bring up these kind of ideas that, you know, there's a cure for unjust society. And the cure for unjust society is in the Quran and in knowledge of Islam. Now, what they interpret as knowledge of Islam is probably not what many scholars of the religion would say is the true meaning of Islam. But if you're not very well versed in the Quran and Islam, then maybe you fall for this kind of stuff. You know, and like I said, there's already this idea that unjust society is cured by the religion. And so now you've fallen into this trap. You know, it's one possible explanation. I'm sure there's others, but that's how I read it, or at least what I was suggesting in my article.
Okay. Who wants to jump in here? Edward?
Yeah, I think to echo what's already been said, you know, seemingly religion hasn't played a prominent role in many of the recruits from Central Asia, looking both at, you know, at Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan as well. And I think, as Sirojdin said, you know, there is something, and Bruce sort of picked up, there is this sort of crisis of identity, and these people who do lack sort of knowledge are more susceptible to these messages. I think many migrants, you know, from my studies of Central Asian migrants in Moscow in particular, you know, many migrants do find religion, or they rediscover religion, become more religious when they're abroad. And for the vast majority, that is about negotiating the harsh conditions of being a migrant in Russia. And for a very small minority, the sort of religion they find they'll grab towards is this more extremist, this takfiri sort of, you know, Islam targets, which clearly divides believers with non-believers and calls for violence. But it is, you know, if we're talking about the broader Central Asian migrant populations, obviously those 3,000 to 5,000, if we believe the estimates that have joined groups like Islamic State, you know, are a very small minority.
You know, we are generally talking about these search for an identity or maybe isolation when they are outside of the country, and inside of the country, we are kind of talking about the possible reasons as a maybe repression and social problems. So kind of little bit push back on that. Maybe David, you would like to jump in here. If the cause of the repression is the authorities in Central Asia, in this case, Uzbekistan, let's say, then why reactions are shown by these people miles away, let's say in Stockholm? Why not in their own country?
Well, I think it's important not to look for simple answers to complex questions, right? So the argument that authoritarian repression produces radicalization, clearly in this case, these are not people who've been in prison for their beliefs and somehow been radicalized in prison. These are people who have not been radicalized inside Uzbekistan itself, right? But there's a bigger question, really, about the almost the indirect impact of repression, which Bruce has alluded to, you know, the extent to which discussion is closed down, for example, and therefore people can't sort of try out these ideas and get them rejected by people around them. And when they come across new ideas about Islam, they're seen as fresh and something different, and something that addresses maybe their particular individual situation. And so that maybe explains why when we see radicalization emerging, it's not against the government of Uzbekistan for the most part. That was true perhaps back in the early 2000s from the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. But since that, for the most part, Uzbek radicalization or radicalization of Central Asians has tended to go into the global movement, global jihadi movement in various ways. So I think we have to look for indirect impacts rather than, say, some kind of simple link between authoritarian repression and radicalization. But I do think there's something there that perhaps differentiates the Uzbek state, not the ethnicity of Uzbek, but the Uzbek state from perhaps Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, and even to a certain extent Tajikistan. But it's a complicated argument, and I think we have to be careful about trying to find this easy answer to what a very complex psychological process.
Sirojuddin, do you want to add on something on this?
The official rhetoric in Uzbekistan is that Islamists are posing a major security threat. By using this method, thousands of people have been repressed. More than 10,000 religious people are still in prison. But observers say that the argument is largely used to justify repressions against those who criticize the regime. The lack of secular opposition in Uzbekistan also played the ground for growing number of religious people with opposition views. You know, today Uzbekistan is trying to open up. The new government understands that there have been mistakes, grave mistakes, and they're trying to find a solution, but they don't have a program, let's say so. I think the cooperation is very necessary between the countries at the moment. Not repressions, but cooperation between power structures, security agencies are very vital. And the difference between societies are also playing the major role at the moment. Let's say in the West, society is very open. Uzbek society is very traditional and closed. And those who come out from this society, they can't find their own life. It is very difficult.
Right. You know, because...
It's a complex issue, and it's very difficult to answer to this question in one sentence.
Obviously, it is very, very complicated, you know, because of the obvious reason. We also ended up just talking about Uzbek nationals today, but even in the neighboring Kyrgyzstan, for example, they used to be one of the most secular environment for any religious practice there, but they also complain, and we have seen some signs of some sort of radicalism is taking place there. So it looks like it is just not only the repression. There are some other elements involved in what is taking place in Central Asia. But it's an important and really a huge discussion. There are lots of moving parts in that, but we have to conclude the discussion. To do so, let me say this, that we are on the Majlis occasionally being criticized by some circles for focusing too much on this topic, but there is certainly the thing called radicalism today in the region, and every indicator shows that this is something on the rise in this or the other way. So what can Central Asian authorities do to avoid further harm? Let's start with you, Edward.
I think as Sirojuddin just mentioned, you know, the policy of sort of very tightly controlling the space for Islamic expression, using accusations of extremism, you know, very loose definitions of extremism to target all manner of regime opponents, be they secular or religious. You know, this is the sort of created across the region thousands of political prisoners and thousands of people who see their ability to express their religion sort of curtailed. So I think, as we've already been discussing, this has in some ways indirectly, as David mentioned, led to Central Asians becoming involved in extremism. So I think addressing that issue is certainly important. I think, you know, given that a lot of the process of recruitment are happening in migrant spaces, you know, looking to what sort of projects or what sort of ways communities can be helped in supporting individuals who may be vulnerable, counseling or outreach within the community. You know, I think these are the sort of ways that would best address this sort of this concept of radicalization rather than the sort of repressive securitization that we've seen.
Hmm. David, is it too late to do anything to address these things, let's say in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan?
Well, never too late, but I do think, and again, it's slightly speculative, but I do think what we're seeing is the outcome of a long process, really. We're talking about Uzbekistan's state building since the Soviet period, and even, of course, the Soviet period has some impact on how people understand Islam with that mixture of forced secularization and religious belief. So it is a long-term process, and I think it's what we, in a way, we need to avoid is these very short-term reactions, which are typically a very securitized restrictions on travel, for example, or restrictions on religion. I do think there are, you know, there are obviously requirements for police cooperation and intelligence cooperation. One of the big problems, of course, has been that Uzbekistan in particular has been a highly authoritarian state, and one with which lots of Western states may not want to cooperate on some of those intelligence sharing issues. It's been very controversial, at least. So again, authoritarianism doesn't really help cross-border and transboundary cooperation. And of course, that's been particularly a problem within Central Asia itself. So I think there are some areas that can be improved. I think Ed's comments were very good, the idea of more integration, more community help. But there is a role for security cooperation, but it really requires some changes in the politics and security of Central Asia, and that's going to be quite difficult to achieve. In the case of Tajikistan, my fear is that what we're seeing is, you know, essentially a repetition of some of the main features of Uzbekistan's policy over the last two decades, and really have come into use in the last 3 to 4 years in particular, including the banning, of course, of the Islamic Renaissance Party and real clampdown on public expressions of religion. And the fear, of course, is that they will then follow a similar process that will be potentially equally unsuccessful in combating this among Tajiks as well.
Okay. Feel free, Sirojuddin, Bruce, if you want to add anything on this topic.
in order to stop the spread of radicalism in Central Asian countries, first of all, ethnostates in Central Asia must understand that without cooperation, it is impossible to achieve that. There must be economic cooperation. There must be social and cultural closeness between these various ethnic groups, which have common history. We must have the free media. We must have free speech, free movement, very basic things that lack in Central Asian countries, especially in Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. So it seems that the future is very murky without solving these problems.
Last point, Bruce, maybe you could talk about this. So, you know, we discussed in Saipov's case, in some other cases, that those individuals were kind of normal guys back home in Uzbekistan or some other Central Asian countries, wherever they come from. But they radicalized outside where they were based, in this case, in the United States here, on Saipov's case. So what can the authorities in Western countries, where alongside people like Saipov, you have millions of peaceful and law-abiding Muslims, what can they do, authorities in Western countries, do to prevent such act of violence?
You know, this is going to be tough. You'd like to say that they could make the new country, the new homeland for these people more welcoming or something like that. But I mean, you know, that's not really the issue. You're always going to have the oddball in every crowd that's just not going to fit in. I mean, that's part of humanity. So this is going to be a problem all the time. You know, certainly spying and watching people is not going to help. I mean, that just puts them right back in the place that they left. You know, you see this, you know, enhanced vetting and stuff. I'm like, oh, what is that? You know, I mean, they're picking up people at the Tashkent airport when they come back from Moscow and Turkey and stuff already. So is the United States supposed to be looking like it's supposed to adopt these kind of tactics too? I would hope not. I suppose if you're looking at it from the point of the host country, so to say, you know, it's just got to be one of those things that you emphasize that especially in the United States case, that this is a country of immigrants and everyone's welcome. And I know that's a tall order considering what's going on in the United States currently. But, you know, America is a land of immigrants, and that has to be a message that's hammered home, you know, and that's said clearly to the various communities in the United States. We're glad you're here, you know, and if there's something we can do to help facilitate your assimilation into our society, then you should alert us to that, you know, right away so that we can try to help you. You know, like I said, the political climate is not such at the moment that I would expect that's something that's going to happen, but...
Keeping the Bruce, also similar incident we have seen in Stockholm, for example, earlier. Yes, the latest one is in New York. Edward, you are in New York. Let me get your thought on this. So what can the authorities in the United States can do to prevent such violence?
Well, no, I think I would echo what Bruce said. I think it's almost impossible to stop these sort of attacks, especially given that it, you know, seemingly he had limited or no contact with ISIS itself, and he obviously used a very unsophisticated method to lead the attack. So I think, you know, there will always be these attacks are almost impossible to completely prevent. But I would agree that, you know, measures like Trump is proposing, such as extreme vetting, would not stop people like Saipov from entering the country. Because, as we know, when he entered the country in 2010, depending on what extreme vetting means, you can't see that there was anything in his profile that would raise any flags from what we know so far. So I agree with Bruce that these sort of punitive measures punishing the 200,000 Uzbeks who are living in the United States for the sake of one person would only be counterproductive. And I think, you know, as Bruce said, creating a more welcoming environment, creating a, you know, supporting activities within that community to help people integrate within that community and then more widely within sort of Western societies are always going to be useful and maybe in some cases will stop people becoming isolated and leading these sort of attacks.
David, let's end this discussion with your point. Is there anything that the countries in the West can learn from each other in dealing a situation like this?
Well, I think that certainly some Western countries, in the UK, certainly very little understanding of militants emerging within Central Asian communities hasn't been on the radar, really, for most security officials. So it may be that there is some cooperation simply in terms of knowledge sharing and ideas and a little bit more understanding of what's happening in the region. And that might well relate to, you know, for example, Sweden, which has an extensive Uzbek community, many of which are well integrated, of course, now the United States, Germany, and Russia as well, perhaps. So there may be some areas for cooperation there, yes. But I think the danger, as always with security cooperation, is that people learn the wrong lessons rather than the right lessons. I think one of the lessons from these recent events is perhaps that the reliance on authoritarian states to, as it were, contain processes of radicalization through repression simply isn't working in Central Asia, and we need to reevaluate some of that leeway that's been given in the past to authoritarianism. So, I think there are some areas there. I think the other area, which we haven't mentioned very much, is, of course, social media, where this raises lots of difficult questions, again, about freedom of expression, the role of technology providers and platforms like YouTube. But I think that clearly is playing a very important role, and particularly the development of Uzbek and Russian language in particular, media seems to be very influential. But somewhere where perhaps there is an area for cooperation in the West as well.
Okay, thank you very much. Dr. David Lewis, Senior Lecturer at the University of Exeter and former Central Asia Director at the International Crisis Group. And big thanks goes to Edward Lemon, Postdoctoral Fellow at the Harriman Institute, and Sirajuddin Talibov, Broadcaster at the Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Uzbek Service, and Bruce Panier, Editor of Kishlok Owozi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, for your time in participation today on the Majlis.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.